Okay, fun seekers, we are about to embark upon a journey. A marvelous journey of discovery, because we are going to learn how to value stocks. It ain't easy. In fact, it's almost impossible. Well, it's not quite impossible. Because what we have to remember is value matters. You ignore value at your peril. And this was said by a mutual fund manager with over 35 years of experience, Greg Ireland. Yeah, he's a down-home spun kind of guy. And he said it very succinctly and very matter-of-factly. You ignore value at your peril. We're going to learn some techniques that I think will not necessarily make you the next Peter Lynch or the next Warren Buffett, but they will tilt the odds in your favor so that when you take a look at a stock, you'll be able to make a reasoned decision about whether or not it is fairly valued or undervalued or wildly overvalued. So let's start on slide number 2 with a definition. Stock valuation. The process by which the underlying value of a stock is established on the basis of its forecasted risk and return performance. At any given time, the price of a share of common stock depends on investors' expectations about the future behavior of the security. So investors are saying, what's going to happen in the future? And a fundamental assertion of finance holds that the value of a stock is based on the present value of its future cash flows. In other words, what is the company going to earn? Businesses are in business to earn money, and we believe that the fundamental assertion, we believe a fundamental, and that as a word we use, we'll come back to it later often, has nothing to do with religion, is that we believe that the value of the stock is based on what it's going to earn in the future. The worth of a company is primarily based on the earnings the company will produce in the future. But wait a minute. If we knew what was going to happen in the future, it would not be called the future. Now, would it? See, there's the problem. Right, yeah. Prediction is difficult, especially about the future. That's Mark Twain, or maybe somebody else. Slide number 3. Stock valuation as described by Burton Malkiel in A Random Walk Down Wall Street. The most fundamental influence on stock prices is the level and duration of the future growth of earnings and dividends. However, future earnings growth is not easily estimated, even by market professionals. So if someone were to ask you, what is the most important factor in determining the future value of a company? In a few words, you could say future dividends, or you could say future earnings, or you could say future dividends. All right? So someone would ask you, maybe on an exam, what is the most important factor in determining the future value of a company? You would say the future earnings. Or, you know, if it's a company that you're buying for dividends, future dividends. But do any of us know what's going to happen in the future? No. So is valuing stock going to be easy? And no, it's not. Obviously, it's not. If it were easy, you've already learned this, haven't you? Right. That's why we're taking the class. Slide number 4, security analysis. The process of gathering and organizing information and then using it to determine the value of a share of common stock. And what we are looking for is often called the intrinsic value, the underlying or inherent value of a stock as determined through security analysis. And the question is, what security analysis methods or measures does one use to determine the intrinsic value of a company? Future dividends, potential capital appreciation, price to earnings ratio, financial ratios, past price performance, the amount of risk. Value is in the eye of the beholder. We're going to learn a few techniques, but there are many, many more. Slide number 5, fundamental analysis. We keep throwing this term around, and we're going to see that it's one of the two major ways to analyze stocks. So we're going to deal with fundamental analysis first, and then we're going to take a look at another one that's very popular with some people later on in future chapters called technical analysis. So it has nothing to do with religion, fundamentalist, religious, no. It's called fundamental analysis. This is the examination of a firm's accounting statements and other financial and economic information to assess the economic value of a company stock. And some of the examples of the fundamentals are the competitive position of the company. Well, is it Coke, Pepsi, or is it Dr. Pepper or RC Cola? What are the growth prospects for the company and the market? What are its profit margins? What are its earnings? What assets are available? What is the company's capital structure, which is a fancy way of saying how much debt, how much equity? Simply put, the value of a stock is influenced by the performance of the company that issued the stock. And that's the basis of fundamental analysis. And we're going to see that technical analysis doesn't look at any of that. We're going to see that later on. Slide number 6. One of the techniques is called financial ratio analysis. And folks, when you read chapter 6, you're going to find that they put this at the end. I put it at the beginning because it's a little more, the math is simpler. The arithmetic is easier. It's a little easier to do. So I put this one in the front. Financial ratio analysis is one method of security analysis that involves looking at certain financial ratio measures. Financial ratios give us a quick and easy method for comparing one company to other companies within their industry or the stock market as a whole. The problem with financial ratios is that there is no single financial ratio that can adequately sum up or summarize the overall general state of affairs, the situation, the predicament, etc., that a company finds itself in. So there are dozens of these things, and we will spend quite a bit of time on those in the next chapter. But we'll look at a few in this chapter. The first financial ratios we will investigate in this chapter will be what are called the price ratios. And we'll look at others in the next chapter. So let's take a look at slide number 7. The most popular stock market statistic by far is the price to earnings ratio, PE. And we discussed PE in chapter 5. Now we're going to look at it in more detail. So to review, the price-to-earnings ratio is actually very simple to calculate. You take the current market price and you divide it by the earnings per share. And they write it as P/E, sometimes PE. And let's take a look at some examples. But before we do that, let's read at the bottom. Historically, PE ratios were in the 5 to 12 range for mature companies, 14 to 20 range for growing companies, and greater than 20 was unusual. But after the run-up in the 80s and 90s, and it happened again, it happened in the 1960s, and it happened in the 1920s, it happens from time to time, it was commonplace for PE ratios to go well above 20. Right now, PE ratios are all over the map. And so we have four different companies here And the really only thing they have in common is they all begin with the letter F, okay? And I chose these because of the fact that they all have different, very different PE ratios. You've heard of all of them. Maybe you haven't heard of First Solar. They make solar panels and solar equipment. So let's take a look at FedEx, right? PE ratio as of February 15th, 2013, 1708. Is that high? Is it low? It's a little on the high side. Not much. Not much, but it's what you'd expect from a company like FedEx, which is doing their best to grow worldwide. And they and UPS are always duking it out. And then there's DHP that has some market share, but not much. So a 17 PE ratio. Little on the high side, but not bad. Ford, 2.95. What's going on here? Well, because Ford has a ratio of 2.95, what investors are saying vis-a-vis FedEx is that they believe the future is much brighter for FedEx than it is for Ford. Now, it doesn't mean they're right. That doesn't mean they're right. That's just what they are saying as they bid the prices up and down. With a PE of 17, investors believe that the prospects, the future prospects for FedEx are more lucrative and brighter than they are for Ford. Now, are they right? We'll know in 3 to 5 years, okay? We'll know. Personally, to me, it looks like Ford is going to survive, plus GM. I mean, they're much smaller companies than they used to be, but it does look like they're going to make it. And remember, they experienced both a GM and Ford and Chrysler near-death experiences. So investors are still discounting, so to speak, the future for Ford. Come back in 5 years and we'll see if investors were right. If they aren't right, if Ford is going to survive, then that's a very low PE and Ford's a great bargain. But exactly. Don't consider it. I'm not saying they go out and buy Ford. I'm just trying to say that investors are not as excited about the prospects for Ford. And if it turns out that Ford does do well, it also could be, we discuss cyclical stocks. Ford is a very cyclical stock, and maybe investors are some, obviously, you can't tell which all the investors, what you can't go around and ask each individual investor, but they might be worried about the United States going into a recession, which kills the cyclical companies, especially the car companies. Now, the third stock we're looking at is Facebook. I'm sorry, what's it called? Farcebook? Facebook, right, Facebook. And let's see what PE they are getting from investors. 1,888? I mean, is that a typo? It can't be right. I have a hard time believing it. Well, you know, just a couple months ago, it was over 100, and the price has jumped from... Started off at 38, went down to 20, and now it's back up to 30-something. So the PE has skyrocketed. So wait, this is insane. What are investors saying about the prospects for Facebook? Right now, investors are saying that Facebook is going to grow at phenomenal rates. Grow their earnings, that is. Well, they have over somewhat 900 million users. Of course, not all of them use it. But are they making any money? Yeah, they're making money, but folks, what do you think? Do you think Facebook's future is so bright that investors are willing to bid up their price relative to their earnings to the point where it's 1,800? An 88? Yeah, well, that's why there's chocolate and vanilla, and some people like strawberry. You have to decide. Personally, I wouldn't touch this turkey with a 10-foot pole. But then again, I hate social networking. I have a Facebook account, and the only reason I have it is so I could grab Wonder Professor, which is the name of my website, and nobody else would grab it and cause confusion with my students. Some of my students are already confused enough. And then the last one, First Solar. The PE for First Solar is not applicable? What's going on here? Well, First Solar is losing money, right? So if you divide the price by a negative number, you're going to get a negative PE. So instead of reporting the price-to-earnings ratio as negative, we just use not applicable or not available. And you found this out when you did your research in Chapter 5, right? Because I asked you to look up the price-to-earnings ratio of many companies, and you saw that some of them just, they weren't making any money, or they were losing money, so there was not applicable. So what I hope is you're starting to get a feel for what the price-to-earnings ratio tells us. It doesn't mean that the market is right. It doesn't mean that investors are correct. And as an investor, you would love to be able to find these inconsistencies, these times when the market is out of favor with companies such as Ford, or is in so much love with companies such as Facebook that they're willing to just raise the price to very lofty levels. Slide number 8. Historically, a company's PE ratio was supposed to match its growth rate. If a company was growing at 20% per year, then a price-to-earnings ratio of 20 was justified. During the internet bubble, many companies had PE ratios in the hundreds. eBay, I'll never forget looking down at the machine and seeing eBay's PE of 10,000. And so, it's nuts. It was just nuts. And here we are back again, 1,888 for Facebook. And the PE ratio not only tells you what investors believe the prospects for the company are, they also tell you how long in years, assuming no changes in the price and no changes in the earnings, it will take for the company to earn back its price. So at the rate that Ford is earning its, earning back its price, 2.953, it'll only take 3 years for Ford to earn back the price of the stock. Whereas FedEx at about 17 will take about 17 years. eBay, it would have taken 10,000 years, which means instead of worrying about Y2K, they would have had to worry about Y5K. You know, when we go from 9,999 years to the year 10,000, why aren't we worrying? We'll be all comfortably dead by then. So, remember our discussion of growth versus value. Growth stocks typically have high PEs, where value stocks typically have low PEs. But remember that a value stock might not necessarily be a good value, and a growth stock with a high PE might be a good value. Now, do you think that eBay was a good value at 10,000? I sure didn't. I just knew. I didn't know when. And, of course, I thought it was not going to be for several years. It happened a whole lot sooner than I thought it was. I thought it would happen. It turned out eBay was a horrible stock at that price. eBay was a great company. Don't get me wrong. They survived, and they made it through the dot-com bubble. But the stock fell from, I think, 200 and something down to 20 or so. Yeah. And now Facebook, right, 1888. Do you think Facebook's going to be able to grow their earnings at such a tremendous rate? Google did it 8 years ago, 7, 8 years ago. But their PE, I think, was like 66, 67, not 1888. So, hopefully now you're getting a feel for what price-to-earnings ratio tells you. It tells you what investors believe the prospects for the company are. And it doesn't mean they're right. And it also alerts you to what I like to think of as imbalances or inconsistencies that you can, as an investor, take advantage of. Slide number 9. Along with price-to-earnings ratio is the price-to-cash flow ratio. Well, now, wait a minute. How's that different? Well, instead of dividing the price into the earnings, you divide the price into the... the other way around. Instead of dividing the earnings into the price, or price on in numerator, earnings the denominator, you divide cash flow per share into the current price. Price is the numerator. Cash flow is the denominator. And you might say, well, wait, how does that cash flow differ from earnings? Well, it's a good question. Cash flow often differs from earnings per share for several reasons. One major reason is depreciation. And you accounting students understand this, right? When you did your trial balances and the like and your income statements, depreciation is not an actual cash expenditure. A company does not write out a check to depreciation. But the IRS allows you to take that as an expense and lower your income. Why? So you don't have to pay as much taxes, right? So depreciation lowers your earnings, but is still cash in your pocket. So you will hear analysts and people in the media talk about good quality versus poor quality earnings. And why is this? Well, because, for example, during the internet mania, many companies were reporting record earnings. At the same time, their cash flow was negative. Well, that doesn't make any sense whatsoever. How can you say, I'm making tons of money, but my checkbook balance is going down? Well, it actually is very simple. Companies such as Lucent Technology in the late 90s were making equipment as fast as they could and selling it to all these new startup telecommunications companies. Now, who is Lucent Technologies? They are the old Bell Labs, Western Electric, the company that made all the equipment for the old AT&T. And they were spun off by AT&T and had a very bright future, or so it seemed, because everybody wanted their equipment. They still build the best telephone equipment in the world, and everybody wanted their equipment. But many of these companies never generated any earnings, so nobody was going to lend them $2 billion to go out and buy a huge telecommunications system from Lucent Technology. So who was lending them the money? Well, it turned out Lucent Technologies was. They were selling the equipment, booking it as earnings, but not getting any cash. They were getting payments from companies that were shaky at best. You ever hear Windstar? There's a reason. They're gone. And all these other startup telecommunication companies that are gone. So these companies owed Lucent Technologies billions and were supposed to pay that off over 30 years. Well, within a couple of years, they disappeared. Lucent Technologies got the equipment back. Yeah, they don't, it's already obsolete. They don't want it back. They want their cash. And they almost went bankrupt. They've survived. They merged with a French company called Alcatel, I think. I'm not sure, Alcatel. And now they seem to be on the mend, but pretty wild, isn't it? So we not only look at the price to cash flow, earnings, we also look at the price to cash flow. Price to sales. Same idea. The price divided by the sales. The current price divided by annual sales per share. Historically, a higher price to sales ratio suggested a higher sales growth, just as a higher PE ratio suggested a higher earnings growth, and a higher price to cash flow suggested a higher cash flow growth. Lower price to sales suggested a lower sales growth. Now, why did they use price to sales? Well, during the internet mania, many analysts used price to sales instead of price to earnings, since most all of the new companies never generated any earnings. So you can't use price to earnings if they don't have any earnings. And their cash flow is not looking too good either. So this price to sales all of a sudden becomes very popular. We can look at their sales. See, their sales are growing. They're still losing money at a tremendous rate. Uh-huh. And then price to book ratio, slide 11. Same idea. Current price divided by the book value. And we looked up, we researched book value in chapter 5, right? It was one of the trickier ones. You have to sort of sneak off the main page if you're using Yahoo. Historically, if the price-to-book ratio was greater than 1, then shareholders believed that the firm was creating value above and beyond the physical assets of the corporation. Well, this makes perfect sense, doesn't it? A company is worth more intact as a going concern, as a company generating earnings, than if you broke it up and sold off all the pieces and paid off the debt. And we discussed this somewhat in Chapter 5. The book value of a stock is the value of the assets the company possesses. And historically, it was fairly close to the price of the stock before modern finance. But now, it is rarely close to the price of the stock because investors have come to understand that it makes more sense for the company to be intact and earning money. If it ever goes below one, the number one, then that means the price is less than the book value per share, and investors really do not think that the prospects for this company are very, very good. And so what do? Well, they bid down the price below the book value, and now the company is in danger of being raided. They're called corporate raiders, takeover artists, private equity firms. Having the assets sold, the debts paid, and the company liquidated. So when a price-to-book ratio goes below 1, it means the price is less than the book value per share, and that's a very dangerous situation for a company to be in. Okay, so now how can we make some money with these things? How can we use the price ratios to predict future stock prices? It's actually easier to do than it is to understand and to explain, if that makes any sense. We're on slide number 12, and we're going to read together. To predict future stock price using the price ratios, we multiply a historical price ratio by the expected future value price ratio denominator. Blah? Huh? What are you talking about, Payano? Look, relax. As I said, it's easier to do it than it is to explain it. So this is from page 204 of the 6th edition. You could find them in the others. They're in the back of chapter 6 of all 3rd, 4th, 5th, and 6th edition. And they use Intel. Now, the 6th edition, every edition they use the current price of Intel. In late 2009, the stock price was $19.40. And the earnings per share at the time were 92 cents. They went back in time, 5 years, to find the average P.E. ratio. Now remember, this is just an average over 5 years. And the analysts believed that in 1 year, they would grow their earnings by 8.5%. Now, did they know that? No, they didn't necessarily know that. They believed that, or maybe Intel told them they thought this is what was going to happen. No guarantees. And so, if it's late 2009, and our earnings per share are 92 cents, we have a 5-year average PE of 20.96, and we believe our earnings are going to grow by 8.5%. To predict the price 1 year from late 2010, we multiply the historical PE ratio times the projected earnings per share. Well, how do we get the projected earnings per share? We multiply the current earnings per share times 100%, in other words, 1, plus the 8.5%, the expected earnings per share growth rate. Multiply the historical price ratio by the expected future value price ratio denominator. It doesn't sound good when you say it, does it? But when you do it, it's actually very simple. Take the historical P/E ratio of 20.96 times the 92 cents that Intel is earning in late 2009 times 100% 1 plus 0.085, and you wind up with $20.92. So the price ratio model is telling us that we believe Intel will be worth $20.92 next year. You understand? So go ahead and do it. I mean, it's very simple, folks. It's just three numbers. Multiply the 5-year average PE ratio times the current earnings per share, 20.96 times 0.92, times 1 plus 8.5% or 1.085, and you get 20.92. Yes, you do it. You do it. Make sure you do it. Make sure you get the same answer, because I could mess up. I copied it from the book. Okay? Now, the price to cash flow is exactly the same. We do exactly the same thing, except this time we use cash flow per share and the 5-year average price to cash flow ratio and the cash flow growth rate. So it's exactly the same calculation. But in this case, we see that Intel was earning but having cash flow of $1.74. Wait a minute. They earned 92 cents and they had cash flow of $1.74? Yes, that is typical of companies like Intel. Why? Because companies like Intel have tremendous capital costs, which it's a fancy way of saying they spend a lot of money to get ready to make their first chip. It costs them $1 billion or $2 billion or whatever to make the very first chip. And then after they make that chip, it costs them $1 or $2. But they have huge upfront capital costs, big expenditures. And they need to depreciate that over time. That's what the IRS says you got to do. And so they depreciate, they use those depreciation expenses to reduce their earnings so they don't have to pay as much taxes to the IRS. But at the same time, it makes it look like they're not earning that much. So by looking at the cash flow per share, we see that they're bringing in actually a whole lot more cash than the earnings shows. In this case, $1.74. And if you go back 5 years from late 2009, you'll see that their price to cash flow ratio average has been 10.85. All right. That's just the average. And the analysts, and maybe, maybe Intel, says that next year we believe our cash flow per share will grow at 7.5%. So we do exactly the same calculation. We multiply the $10.85 5-year average price to cash flow times the $1.74 of cash flow per share times 100% 1 plus the 7.5% 1.075. And we wind up with $20.29. You know, pretty darn close to what we predicted in the previous price to earnings ratio prediction. Right? So now let's go to slide 14. Price to sales is done exactly the same way. Are you getting it? Because once you do it a few times, it's really pretty simple. Their sales for late 2009 were $6.76. Their 5-year average price to sales ratio was 3.14. And they believe that the sales were going to grow by 7%. The analysts said it, or Intel said it. So we do exactly the same calculation. 3.14, which is the 5-year average price to sales ratio, times $6.76 of sales per share times 1 plus 7%, 1.07, 100% plus 7%, 1.07, and we get $22.71, which is a bit more optimistic than the previous two predictions. So now, if you're completely lost, I want you to stop the presentation right now and go back and do these calculations on your own using a calculator. They're not that hard. People just look at me and they go, huh, I don't understand. And then after they do it a couple times, they go, oh, this is easy. And it is. It's not that hard. The math is, the arithmetic is not that hard. It's not even math. Math is when the numbers disappear and you wind up with letters, funny looking letters. Slide number 15. Reality check! Can we reasonably assume that the formulas on the previous slides will give us realistic figures? Well, dear students, for many companies, yes. But for many companies, no. There are countless other factors at work. It is like trying to predict the weather, only worse. The major assumption of these price models is that the price multiples will remain constant. However, we are using 5-year averages without taking into account the variances and the standard deviations of the averages. Remember the variances and the standard deviation in any one year? Is it reasonable to expect predictions from these models to be accurate if the variances and the corresponding standard deviations of the averages are large? Not really, because, yeah, sure, the average might be 20, the average might be 3, the average might be 13 or whatever it is, but in any one year it might be 22, 4, 17, 9. Yeah. Slide number 15. Reality check continued. For the record, the price of Intel 1 year later in late 2010 was around $20.50. Not bad, eh? Well, one out of four ain't good. That was the only one out of the third, fourth, and fifth, and sixth editions that was close. The predictions for the third, the fourth, and the fifth editions for the next year prices of Intel were far from the actual prices. The third edition predictions were $19.61, $27.54, and $31.63, and the actual price 1 year later was $33.50. And for the fourth edition, the predictions were $50.84, $43.49, and $40.92, and the actual price 1 year later was $17. About whack. And then for the fifth edition, $25.47, $25.36, $29.63, and the actual price 1 year later was $20. So the third edition was far too low. It was pretty low. The fourth edition and the fifth edition predictions were far too high. Gives you a whole lot of confidence in the price models, doesn't it? Well, take heart. The prediction for the Disney calculations, Walt Disney Company, from the book were actually much closer to the actual prices. So I guess the takeaway here is that for companies like Intel, which are incredibly cyclical and technology changes so fast, these price models are pretty much useless. One out of four. But for companies like Disney, the technology doesn't change that much for Disney. They make their money off of movies and their theme parks and selling pieces of garbage that they buy from China for $50 to people. Toys and other ancillary products. All right. So those were the price models. Make sure you go back and understand them and can do the calculations. There is a worksheet, actually there's two of them, that do use the price models. And in the face-to-face class, we would stop now and do worksheet number one, the first three problems on worksheet number one, maybe the first three problems on worksheet number two, to make sure that you can do these, because you can do these. And review what we've just discussed. When we come back, we will take a look at one of the most, in my humble opinion, powerful prediction models and valuation models, and that is called the dividend discount models. So make sure you understand what we just went through, and then get ready for some real powerful stuff, and take this stuff seriously, folks. Study hard, because it might not make you, I mean, I'm not saying it's going to make you the best stock picker in the world, the next Peter Lynch, the next Warren Buffett, but at least you'll have an understanding of what's going on when people make their, not everybody, but many people, when they make their decisions. And as we'll see, it ain't easy, as we've seen. See you in our next presentation for Chapter 6, Dividend Discount Models.